Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we start with some debt-related news and facts for the week. From an article by Zach Carter in Alternet, Elizabeth Warren, protecting the middle class from financial predators. For years, federal banking regulators at the Office of Comptroller of the Currency, OCC, the Office of Thrift Supervision, OTS, and the Federal Reserve have helped the nation's largest banks wage war on the U.S. middle class. But President Barack Obama wants to change all that with a new regulator that answers exclusively to consumers, not bank balance sheets. Alternet Economics editor Zach Carter discussed the proposal to establish a Consumer Financial Protection Agency, the CFPA, with the woman who came up with the idea, Harvard University Law School professor Elizabeth Warren. After defending the American middle class for decades, Warren currently chairs the Congressional Oversight Panel for the Troubled Asset Relief Program. And this is a question and answer interview. From Zach Carter, how did the existing federal bank regulators facilitate today's economic crisis, and how can a CFPA help? From Elizabeth Warren, the big arc of the story is that 30 years ago, we had laws that put some basic fairness into the consumer credit market. Over time, the large financial institutions captured the regulators who were supposed to be the cops on the beat to enforce those laws. They also pumped hundreds of millions of dollars into Washington to make sure that no new cops were put on the beat. Without good laws, the industry started selling ever more deceptive products, and their friendly regulators looked the other way. For example, when a dispute arose between a consumer and a bank, the regulator consistently chose the side of the banks. This was particularly true with the OCC. From Zach Carter, the federal regulators even joined the bank lobby to file lawsuits, didn't they? From Professor Warren, they filed lawsuits to protect the banks because the banks needed the help of the government against those big, tough consumers, right? So they kept pushing more and more deceptive products, and they ultimately destabilized not just the American family, but the entire American economy. Once the economy crashed, the industry demanded bailouts from the taxpayer. So now we're writing the final chapter of this story. And the final chapter is about who is in control moving forward. Will the banks continue to select their own regulators and write their own rules? Or will there be someone in Washington who wants to look out for consumers and who will be accountable to them? From Carter, so the regulators go from being cops or enforcement agencies to being something very close to lobbyists and advocates for the banking industry, particularly the large banks. Professor Warren responds, they went from being cops to being the lookout driver. They stand out in front while the banks fleece their customers. And time and again, the regulators believed it was their job to defend and support the banks against customers. And from Zach Carter, the bank lobby has made the CFPA their top target since President Obama rolled out the proposal for it back in June. What are the banks so afraid of? Professor Warren says, that's right. In fact, I think their language was that they intended to kill it. The new agency would put an honest cop back on the beat. That's all. And that's what's so amazing. Think about this. The agency wouldn't have much more power than the Fed or the OCC currently has over credit cards, home mortgages, and other consumer loans. The difference is that the consumer agency would be an honest cop. It would be an agency headed by someone who cares about consumers and who would be accountable to the people if consumers were being taken advantage of. And for Mr. Carter, so what are the crucial provisions that need to be passed? Professor Warren, independence is at the heart of the proposal. It's not that we need some specific new rule. It's that we need an independent agency to write and enforce the rules that cares about consumers, not just bank profits. And finally, from Zach Carter, the CFPA portion of the financial reform bill took some pretty significant blows as it moved through the House Financial Services Committee. They cut a provision that would have required any bank offering complex loans to offer a plain vanilla loan alongside it, and exempted the 8,000 out of 8,200 banks from the CFPA enforcement. How damaging are those revisions? And from Professor Warren, the small banks were exempted from primary enforcement, but the agency would continue to have secondary enforcement power over them, and they would still be subject to all the same rules. The rule writing authority applies to everyone. The CFPA would also still be the primary enforcer against big banks and the non-bank lenders, the mortgage brokers, and the other folks who operate at the state level and not at the national level. But for community banks, the consumer agency would sit shotgun with the safety and soundness regulator. They wouldn't be totally excluded from the process. And this is from Zach Carter, who is economics editor for AlterNet. And next, got credit card debt? You still have rights. By Lisa Kaiser of Shepherd Express, Milwaukee. How consumers can protect themselves from debt buyers and collection agencies. If you've been hearing from collection agencies about your old credit card debt, you're not necessarily at their mercy. Although collection agencies and the lenders and debt buyers that hire them are stepping up their efforts to recover old debt from credit card holders, they may not be automatically entitled to that money. Unfortunately, a few in-debt consumers realize that many state consumer protection laws are on their side. It's terribly difficult and sometimes impossible or illegal for credit card companies and collection agencies to recover their money. But that doesn't stop these companies from trying to collect. In fact, they count on consumers' lack of awareness of the laws so that they'll pay up in full. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And I'm talking about how you still have rights even though you have credit card debt, taken from an article by Lisa Kaiser of the Shepherd Express, Milwaukee. Debt buying has become big business in recent years as lenders discovered that the old debt they carried on their books, even if that old debt was discharged during bankruptcy proceedings, might be worth something to someone. There's a lot of money to be made in squeezing the consumer, said Milwaukee attorney Michael Mack, who specializes in consumer debt settlement. Much like the exploitation that occurred in the subprime lending industry, this seemingly worthless debt is sold to debt buyers, many of which are owned by hedge funds. Some are even traded publicly on the stock exchange. Billions of these seemingly worthless debts have been sold. Debt buyers purchase a lender's delinquent accounts for pennies on the dollar. Typically, the buyer receives names of delinquent account holders, account numbers, and amounts overdue. These accounts are so cheap to purchase that a debt buyer could collect on only some of the debt and still make a tidy profit,
even if they have to hire collection agencies and attorneys to do so. That's when the phone calls and letters kick in. O. Max Gardner III, a North Carolina-based consumer bankruptcy attorney, said the debt buyer's business model is based on consumers' unwillingness to fight the claim in court. That gives the debt buyer a default judgment, meaning that the consumer is on the hook. Merely settling with the debt buyer for a fraction of the debt provides them with a profit. Even if you collect 20 or 30 cents on the dollar, that's 10 or 15 times what you paid for the account, Gardner said. And all they're buying is electronic data. They're buying the name, the account number, and the balance. They're not buying any of the original loan documents, the bill statements, or correspondence. So if you challenge any of these cases, they can't prove anything. The catch for debt buyers is that consumers still have some rights. Unfortunately, many consumers aren't aware that they have significant protections in court. They wind up receiving harassing phone calls and letters, seeing their credit rating reduced to shreds, and eventually settling their claims with the collection agency. Little do they know that the burden of proof is on the credit card company or debt buyer. Under many states' consumer acts, lenders and collection agencies must provide complete documentation of the borrower's delinquent account. Without the complete documentation, they do not have a legal claim. According to Attorney Mack from Wisconsin, that means the collection agency must show everything from the borrower's application for the credit card to all of the statements and even the notices of changes in policy. In essence, the court won't take the most recent account statement as proof of the outstanding balance. The lender must show how it arrived at that amount. We see nothing absurd about requiring the banks who brought the complaint to retain the records of charges for which they wish to collect payment, appeals court judges concluded in a 2007 challenge to the Wisconsin Consumer Act, for example. Consumer Attorney Mack said that requiring the lender to provide all of the account's documentation is imperative because the balance could have been incorrectly calculated. The consumer can dispute those records, Mack said. Credit card companies make mistakes all the time. What's more, the attorney representing the lender must do some due diligence to ensure that he or she isn't filing a frivolous claim. If there are no supporting documents, Mack says, the attorney shouldn't be filing the claim at all. There's another area of consumer debt in which debt buyers are running amok and engaging in illegal activity, trying to collect on debt that's been written off or discharged during bankruptcy proceedings. It's amazing to see documents filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission where one of the big debt buyers has made an agreement to buy Chapter 7 charge-off debt, and it's absolutely worthless, Attorney Gardner said. Oftentimes, the old forgiven debt will remain on the consumer's credit report because the original lender hasn't updated its records with the major credit bureaus. There are a number of class actions that have been filed, many in California, against Experian, TransUnion, and Equifax, based on their failure to monitor with proper software programs individual consumers' debt reports to make sure that this is not happening, Gardner said. One thing that the credit reporting agencies always reported was bankruptcy. They always reported the discharge. Debt buyers who purchase these discharged accounts are allowed to report the debt in the name of the original lender. Obviously, a credit report that shows an outstanding debt to Chase, for example, on a credit card, is going to have more impact than one to a collection agency, Gardner said. Gardner said that a consumer typically isn't aware of the zombie debt, or debt that comes back from the dead, until he or she is applying for a new loan for a car or refinancing a mortgage. You're in a kind of coercive situation where you've made plans to proceed with the transaction, and at the last minute you're told about this $900 credit card debt, and that's got to be repaid so that you can rescore your FICO and pay off the loan you didn't know you had, Gardner said. That's like in The Godfather, the offer you can't refuse situation. So what can you do about old debt? When receiving a call from a collection agency, get the caller's name, company, and phone number, and the debt that's being collected. Ask for verification of the debt in writing. Don't argue with the caller. Once you receive the letter, decide whether settling the claim, fighting it, or filing for bankruptcy is your best option. Each individual situation is unique. You may want to consult with an attorney. Communicate in writing with the agency. Remember that you do have some rights, even if the collection agency is putting pressure on you to pay in full. And finally, monitor your credit report to ensure that zombie debt has been erased.
If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now let's continue our account of The Two Income Trap, which is a book, Why Middle Class Parents Are Going Broke, by Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Warren Tyagi. And it gives some solutions to what is really the biggest crisis families face today. I'd like to start with the credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are based on or directly from the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend that you read their books, All You're Worth and The Two Income Trap. You can also review all of the shows, which are an integrated educational program, at www.kruufm.com. Look in the archives under Life and Debt.
Last week, I started discussing the myth of the immoral debtor, which is another myth about financial failure. This is a myth about good and evil, ethics and righteousness, as it were. It's the story of how in the good old days, people paid their bills no matter what, not because they had more money, but because they had more honor. It was the right thing to do. They would have died of shame rather than default. And this myth is that now that old morality is dead, we live in a time of easy virtue and decaying standards. Professor Warren looked into this very closely and indicated that the myth arose without any proof. It's the belief that people who are in the know understand that cheating is rampant, that millions of Americans are bankrupt or near bankrupt because they run up huge bills and then expect society to pay for them. And when the creditors come calling, they stall, lie, and sooner or later declare bankruptcy so they can walk out on their debts. Professor Warren points out that one problem with the previous golden age of bill paying is that no one can agree on when it actually occurred. Think about that. This is typical of many things that were held up to be superior in the past. There's the concept that bankruptcy no longer carries with it the social stigma that it did 20 years ago. For example, bankruptcy is becoming a first stop for some rather than a last resort, according to many powerful politicians. Some put the decline in the 1980s as the time when the standard started declining. But if we look back into the 1930s, Thomas D. Thatcher, the Solicitor General of the United States at that time, expressed the often repeated claim that numerous industrial workers were running up bills without intention or ability to pay, and then filing a petition in bankruptcy. Then we can go back a little further in time, in the 19th century, when arbiters of public morality with similar complaints were disseminated in the media. And then back to the 18th century, where a primary example was the venerable preacher Cotton Mather, who in 1716 used his pulpit to decry the early American colonists who could not pay their debt, for which they are to be indicted as not having the fear of God before their eyes. In essence, it seems that the golden age of bill paying was always
in the past, and that previous generations always had higher standards and greater integrity. As Professor Warren sums up, if we listen to the public moralist, we would be left with the impression that America's moral fortitude has been rapidly disintegrating for at least 300 years. So what about today? Have Americans become cunning financial manipulators, ready to walk out on their debts without a moment's hesitation? Well, let's turn to the numbers. The conviction that filing for bankruptcy no longer carries the stigma it once did is so widespread that it requires no proof, according to most commentators trying to verify the argument. But that logic is usually circular. People would not file for bankruptcy if they felt stigmatized by it. Therefore, if bankruptcies are up, stigma must be down. Now, that's impossible to disprove, and it sounds pretty good if no one pushes too hard on the logic. A few economists have actually written about the stigma, but the results are pretty much the same. They focus on a few economic measures, the unemployment rate, the GDP level, the inflation rate, without ever actually talking to families, either those who file for bankruptcy or those who do not. The researchers then declare that a decline in stigma accounts for anything and everything that the bare numbers don't explain. For example, if bankruptcy goes up while inflation goes down, it must be that stigma diminished because no other explanation presents itself. Professor Warren says that despite all of this, there is plenty of evidence that stigma is alive and well among families in financial trouble. One long-term study of family economics found that fully half of the bankrupt families were unwilling to admit, even in an anonymous survey, that they had filed for bankruptcy. Moreover, economists have calculated that there are millions of families who, after they took account of the legal fees and other costs, would be better off financially if they sought the protection of the bankruptcy courts. According to one estimate, about 17% of all households in the United States would see a significant improvement in their balance sheets if only they were willing to sign a bankruptcy petition. That's 18 million households that would profit from a bankruptcy filing compared with the 1.5 million that actually filed, suggesting that at least 16.5 million families are still trying to pay their debt for some reason that has nothing to do with the legal rules. In short, bankruptcy may look like just another financial planning tool to certain economists who study it, but it is very different for the families who actually have to file the petitions and show up in court. Again, many commentators seem concerned that families who file for bankruptcy are not sufficiently contrite. This goes right up to the Senate, where senators feel it should be a priority to recapture the stigma associated with bankruptcy filing. But as a bankruptcy attorney, and talking to many of my colleagues, and from Professor Warren, who has study this in depth, the idea that they do not feel bad enough about filing their bankruptcy would come as a shock to most of the families who have filed. Those of us who are trying to help the people who are in this economic plight know that the anguish, shame, and embarrassment these people experience over their situation is real and compelling. The amount of stress is huge. In Professor Warren's research, several mothers were willing to talk with them only on the condition that they did not use the word bankruptcy during the telephone interview for fear that a child might pick up the extension phone and hear that dreaded word. Some said that just hearing the word still makes them cry, and they asked Professor Warren to refer simply to, quote, the event. More than 80% of the families interviewed by Professor Warren and her staff reported that they would be embarrassed or very embarrassed if their families, friends, or neighbors learned of their bankruptcy. And in fact, as a bankruptcy attorney, this is nearly a universal sentiment among clients. That leads to the question, so why would families file for bankruptcy even if they felt ashamed? The striking bottom line is that they believed they had no other choice. The analogy that Professor Warren uses is, Nudity. Pretty much everyone over the age of 3 feels extremely embarrassed about getting naked in front of a stranger. But when people come down with a serious illness, when they are frightened by odd lumps or unexpected pains, they willingly shed their clothes in front of a bevy of medical professionals. They don't bare their bodies because they feel no stigma against nudity. They take off their clothes because it is the only way to get help. And that's the way it is for more than 1 million families each year, and this number is rising. Families who are given the choice between losing their homes or filing for bankruptcy, they'll choose bankruptcy. When faced with the choice between never paying off credit card debts and getting a chance to start fresh again, they choose bankruptcy. It was embarrassing, it was humiliating, and they tried to hide it from their friends and families, but they did it. We have to understand that there is a blow to people's sense of self-worth, and it can be deeply painful. There is self-worth and pride that is associated with our lives, and unlike the major corporations which file for bankruptcy, there is a human sensitivity and component that people have. Now, the myth of the immoral debtor has some variations. Some critics claim that families have gotten sneakier. For example, federal Judge Edith Jones, at one time a potential appointee to the Supreme Court, asserted that bankruptcy is increasingly seen as a big game, with the losers being those who live within their means, while the bankrupts pursue more interesting and carefree lives. Frankly, to those of us who help people in this extreme financial position, this kind of statement somewhat breaks our hearts. Again, it's that concept that in the good old days, families would work their fingers to the bone to pay off their debts. But today, going back to Judge Jones, bankruptcy more and more is looked at as an option of first rather than last resort. Families could pay their bills, but would rather take the easy way out. And we will evaluate this kind of claim, but we should look at a few basic facts about what it means to file for bankruptcy. First, bankruptcy offers a one-time get-out-of-jail-free card. Although the specifics vary, the basic ideas are the same for both corporate and personal bankruptcies. When someone or some entity has gotten into serious financial trouble, he, she, or it may seek protection from creditors by filing for bankruptcy. The bankruptcy judge will supervise the case to ensure that creditors are repaid to the extent possible while the debtor gets a chance to recover from disaster and make a fresh start. For a business that is failing, the court takes legal jurisdiction over the company's assets and makes every effort to treat the various creditors equitably, which usually means only partial payment of the outstanding debts. In some cases, such as high-profile dot-com failures for the early 2000s, the business is shattered and the assets are sold off piecemeal, with all proceeds parceled out to the various creditors. In other cases, such as Kmart and United Airlines of some years ago, a portion of the debt is written off and a leaner, restructured company is allowed to continue its operations. For an individual who files bankruptcy, the process is similar, but we're not seen as businesses. However, the courts take legal control over the assets, the bank accounts, the house, the car, everything right down to the cat and the dog, or the old bike with the flat tire. Some of these items will be exempt, but those that turn out not to be are liquidated and used to repay creditors to the extent possible. So, for example, if something is not exempt, like an excessive amount of money in a bank account or stock portfolios, these would be emptied or sold, and the proceeds used to repay past debts. And next week, we'll continue by looking at some of the concepts here, particularly exemptions, which allow people to start over having the basic subsistence items, such as clothes, household goods, and in many cases, their house. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt-manageable life.